I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. I'll bet you remember the case of the TV clown who did the morning show for kids, Captain Bob or somebody. One day when he thought they had gone to a commercial break, he groaned out loud, "Well, that ought to shut up the little bastards." And of course, they had to take him off the air. It is said to have happened in every TV market in this country, but it may never have happened at all. Well, you probably heard about the three Midwestern ladies scared stiff about getting mugged in New York. They're in an elevator. They push the 10th floor button, but the elevator goes to the basement, and a scary-looking man gets on with a dog. The man says, "Sit," and the women drop to the floor. But, of course, he was talking to his dog, and it turned out he was blind. Or how about the college classic about the final exam in philosophy? The question on which the students were to write in blue books for 2 hours turned out to be simply, "Why?" The only student to get a straight A in the course answered, "Why not?" They're urban legends, all of them. The first hallmark of an urban legend is that it's told second, third, or fourth hand as if it must be true, though maybe none of them are. They're susceptible to infinite variations in detail, yet in some mysterious way, many of them are all the same and easily typed. The hitchhiker group, the pet group, the exploding toilet, or the sexcapade group. Connection listeners, do you know an urban legend when you hear one? And would you share one with Connection listeners and the folklorist Jan Harald Brunvand, the world's foremost authority? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Or do you want to argue that these stories are true? At least the one you know that your sister-in-law told you has got to be true because it happened to somebody that she knows or thinks she knows. Give it a shot at 1-800-423-TALK. Jan Harald Brunvand, welcome. We've enjoyed your books a lot. Give us a few of your favorites, just to sort of set the bar.
You know, you've told several of my favorites already this morning, and I almost feel like taking notes because you illustrated so well the aspect of variation. For example, I'd never heard that the man that gets on the elevator with the dog was blind.
That's what my uncle told me.
Yeah. I've always heard that he was a black man, and he turned out to be a celebrity, turned out to be Lionel Richie or Eddie Murphy, and he was just out walking his dog, as these celebrities often do. They just go off, you know, in the city walking their dogs. When people ask me what is my favorite urban legend, a lot of times I say that's like asking a chemist, what is your favorite element? Because for a folklorist, it's sort of all data, you know. All of these bizarre stories, some of them funny, some of them scary, are just part of the mass of material that we collect and compare and try to study. But I must confess that one of my favorites is a story about a woman who comes out here to Utah skiing in the winter, let's say from the Midwest. Not a very good skier. She rides the lift to the top of the mountain, decides, you know, it's time for her to take a run all the way from the top to the bottom, but she needs to use the restroom, and she doesn't see any lodge or restroom up there, and she's not even sure she can get her skis on and off properly, so she skis around behind some trees or bushes and just pulls her pants down, but she slips and slides down the mountain backwards and has an accident and is rescued by the ski patrol. When she's in the first aid room, according to the story, and I hear this every year in the ski areas out here, you know, with the different sources from California, from Europe or something. So she's in the first aid room. They bring in a stretcher, and on it is another victim of an accident, and he's wearing a ski patrol parka. And the woman looks over and says, "You know, I'm a beginner, and it's understandable I would have an accident, but what about you?" And he said, "Well, I was riding up in the lift this morning to meet my class. Suddenly this woman went by under the lift with her pants down backwards, 50 miles an hour. I leaned over for a better look, and I fell out of the chair. What about you?" What I like about the story is it never follows up, you know, with her saying anything. You just black out right there. So I think that's my favorite.
That's news to us. We were talking about this whole genre of blue book, college blue book, urban legends. There was another one familiar in my time about the kid who hadn't studied at all, but he stayed up all night, maybe 2 days in a row on Benzedrine, crammed everything about the course, mastered it entirely, wrote an absolutely brilliant blue book after blue book after blue book. He just couldn't
stop. Is this the guy who wrote it all on one line?
Well, same idea. You know, they called him in and they said it was just one sort of loopy line after line. There was nothing, basically.
Yeah, what I heard it was that he wrote the entire thing on one line of the first page, never turned the page, never skipped the line. There are a lot of these blue books.
Tell the one about the two guys who said, "We had a flat tire, I missed the exam, can we make it up?" And the professor said, "Sure." You know that one? That's in one of your books?
Yeah, that's often repeated and attributed to a specific person. And it may well be that a professor somewhere sometime has tried this little ploy. They come in with their excuse. They were traveling somewhere. They were hurrying to get back. They had a flat tire, and they need to take a makeup exam. And the teacher listens to the story and says, okay, you go to this room and you go to this room, separates the two. And here's the exam. And the first question is, which tire? So, you know, they have a chance. They still have a chance. But most of the Blue Book stories turn on the fact that the Blue Books all look alike, right? You know, they're all the same size, color, right, shape, and so on.
Same nightmare.
And, right. And one I like involves a student who is in a big class section, which is the exam is being given by a graduate student who's sort of the proctor. And he's very officious and self-important. And he tells the class, when I call time, you all have to quit writing. And this one student just wants to finish that last paragraph. And he's the last one to come up. The whole pile of Blue Books is there. And this proctor says, I won't take your exam. I told you to stop. You didn't stop writing. And the student says, what'll happen? Well, you'll fail. And that's all there is to it. And the student draws himself and says, do you know who I am? And the graduate student says, no. And furthermore, I could care less. And the student says, good. And he just sticks the book in the middle of the pile. You know? Who will know?
Blue Book heroism.
Yes.
You know, there are so many. There are other types. There's one type that afflicts, I don't know, it afflicts anybody who gets it on the Internet. But it's specifically the NPR story. Nina Totenberg reports from the Supreme Court that there will be no more public subsidy for NPR. And would you please instantly write to your congressman and send this email to 100 friends and save public radio in America?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm certainly in favor of saving public radio.
Well, so are we, of course. But
it's wonderful how these specifics get in. Nina Totenberg is named, and you're given an address to which you should send this appeal and so on.
Have you heard about the Klingerman virus?
Yes, I have. In fact,
does that qualify?
I think it's a parody of an urban legend. It's supposed to be a package, an actual package or an envelope that you get that has a real virus in it, as opposed to a computer virus that comes as an attachment to an email file or something. And it sounds like a parody of an urban legend. It sounds like somebody just, you know, thinking about the computer viruses and making up another form of it. But I don't know.
Some of these legends that are recounted in your books, you know, have a considerable narrative beauty about them. There's one that that Billy Graham told. He credited somebody else. He didn't sort of vouch for its absolute authenticity. But the story was specifically about a named Philadelphia neurologist who was going to bed. It's a dark night. There's a knock on the door, and it's a little girl begging, in effect, for medical care for her mother. And he follows her to the mother's house and praises her for the daughter that was so resourceful to get in there. And the mother looks up at him and says, my daughter died 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And here in the closet are the very clothes that he saw on this child. And they're warm and dry. Obviously, this was some sort of angel.
Yeah.
In the story, it sounds a lot actually like a Dostoevsky story about the dream of a ridiculous man, in which a little girl tugs on the conscience of a man who's about to kill himself and saves his life and whatnot. But it also gets us into the question of sort of the morphology, the general types here of kinds of stories. What's going on?
Well, you know, that one, I have a chapter on that one in my latest book, which is called The Truth Never Stands in the Way of a Good Story. And I call that The Ghost in Search of Help for a Dying Person. I started with the Billy Graham version because he's so well known, and so many thousands of people must have read it in his book, which was a book about angels. Billy Graham said he read it in Reader's Digest. I have never found it in Reader's Digest, but I did find many, many other variations of the story. And when I saw that quite a few of them were attributed to this doctor, Silas Weir Mitchell, turn of the century, early 20th century doctor in Philadelphia, I looked into that, and it turned out that it's a widespread ghost story. It's told in Russia, among other places. But Weir Mitchell apparently told it on himself in the first person as a kind of a prank, and then could never live it down. All the rest of his life, people associated the story with him.
You call this the child in search of help for a dying person type.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, or I say the ghost in search of help. That kind of gives it away, doesn't it? Because then you know from the start that it's a ghost.
But it's
the
a child.
Titles, yeah, the people that tell these stories don't usually have titles. They just say, "Have you heard this one about?" And I or other folklorists make up titles to help identify them, or sometimes identify them with numbers. In a way, this is the exception to the rule that most of these stories are not supernatural, are not implausible. I began my career as an urban legend guy writing a book about the Vanishing Hitchhiker story, and so I picked one of the exceptions. That also is a ghost story. But most of these stories are quite plausible.
Give us the Vanishing Hitchhiker story.
Oh, you know, that's an old, old story. That's the one about the person who often it's a young girl who is seen in a light party dress on a cold, windy night standing by the side of the road. The driver, sometimes she's holding out her thumb, sometimes she's just standing there. A driver stops for her. She gets in the back seat, and she says very little. Mostly she just gives the address where she wants to go in the next town. And when he gets there, turns around to let her out, she's gone. She's vanished. One way I like to refer to this, if you remember the singer Dickie Lee in the 60s, he had a song called Laurie or Strange Things Happen.
Hmm.
And he included the detail that's in many of the traditional versions of her borrowing a sweater from the driver. She's cold and shivering, and he leans over to the backseat and hands her a sweater. Then he, in the song and in many of the legends, he goes to the address, knocks on the door, and her parents say, "That's our daughter who died 10 years ago in an automobile accident on prom night." And I think it's funny in a way. He says, "What about my sweater?" And they say, "Well, you can check the grave in the cemetery down the street." And sure enough, there it is, you know, draped across the tombstone of Laurie. And then the chorus of Dickie Lee's song was, "Strange things happen in this world." But there are lots of variations of this. Sometimes the hitchhiker is a male. Sometimes he is later said to be Jesus or an angel or a saint or something. Sometimes there's a message of some kind, you know, Mount St. Helens will erupt next week. But the story is always told after the event.
Yeah.
And so it isn't a true prophecy in that sense.
Let me ask you, Mr. Brumman, how many recognizable types of urban legends are there? Some people say there are only six jokes in the world, but I mean, how many urban legends are there?
Well, I put an index of urban legends, a type index, into one of my books, and I ended up with about 400. But many of them are
400
the
types.
Same patterns. Yeah, many of them are the same patterns with different content. It's a kind of a moot question because, as you say, the plots, you know, the structure of many of the stories is quite similar. You know, you'll have a cat in one or a dog in one or something else. But I think of them in terms of large blocks. They're automobile stories, animal stories, accidents, horrors, sex, business, celebrities, academe.
There was
like
a whole subtype of black American urban legends that Skip Gates wrote about a few years ago, but everybody talked about them. I mean, for example, that it was said to be gospel truth that Ann Taylor, or some women's clothing manufacturer, didn't make skirts with large hips because they didn't want black women in the stores or something like that.
No, that was Liz Claiborne.
Sorry,
It wasn't Liz Claiborne. It wasn't any of these designers, but the story has been told on most of the big-name clothing designers. And a lot of times they'll say that this person was on Oprah. Can you think of a worse place to make this statement? And, of course, anyone who was on Oprah and who was interviewed on Oprah, there would be a tape somewhere. There would be an audience for it. It's just hearsay. And it's a negative stereotype.
What gives these legends their sticky quality, their staying power?
Well, part of it, I think, is that people who hear them from a friend, a family member, a coworker, a neighbor. You know, they don't think of it as an untruth, and the person telling it is not telling a tall tale or lying, a whopper or anything like that. They're passing on a bit of news. And I think people have the sense that this is something that didn't quite make it in the newspaper, but, you know, I have the inside story. People like to be the center of attention and tell these things. And I also like to say they're easy to tell. They're not like jokes where, you know, where timing and dialect and getting all the details right is essential to telling a good joke. These are more kind of extended. People don't memorize the text. They reconstruct it each time. They change a little bit. And many times the general point in the story is something you can relate to. It's about crime. It's about products, contamination, or pets, or something like that.
1-800-423-8255, the urban legend connection. Stories so fantastic, they must be true. And you heard it from somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who was actually there. 1-800-423-TALK. Bill is on the line.
Hey, Chris.
Welcome, Bill.
Thanks. I love these things.
I believe your story already.
I love these things. I can't believe some of the intelligent, seemingly intelligent people that repeat them as if they were a fact. The one I've heard is about the this modestly dressed couple walks into the president of Harvard, Harvard's office, you know, back in the late 1800s. And they say, you know, our son went here for a year, and then unfortunately he died, and we'd like to put up a building in his memory and name it after him. And the president of Harvard gives him a hard time and says, are you kidding? You people obviously couldn't afford anything like that. We're talking millions of dollars to put up a building, you know, and then dismisses them summarily from his office. And from there, Mr. and Mrs. Leland Stanford went back to California. Now, you know, in the website, the Stanford website, they did have a child who died, but he was not yet 16, and there's no mention of him having gone anywhere to school. And when he dies, Mr. Stanford says, the children of California shall be our children. And they did go to Harvard to talk about ideas they had for starting a school. But I was even at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon a few weeks ago. It was about customer service, and a guy stood up and told that story as an example of poor customer service.
Oh, my. Yeah, and it's wonderful how there's a kernel of truth to it, the name, the son,
right.
The establishment of the university, and so on. Yeah. Did you then confront the speaker and say, no?
No. I thought that impolite.
Yeah, I know.
You nodded sagely and went back to the web to find out, could it really be true?
Yeah.
The title of one of our guests, Jan Harald Brunvand's books, is Too Good to Be True. It's the colossal book of urban legends. 1-800-423-8255. Robert is calling from Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Yes, I'll just relate one that happened when I was in high school in the late 50s about a gentleman who bought a Corvette. Because it was someone had died in it, and in his death, he had lingered in the vehicle for so long that the odor from the decomposing body made the thing very inexpensive, and you could buy it for $500. But it recycled 25 years later, and I heard this from three different parts of the country via the telephone, when someone answered an ad in a shopping newspaper for a 1970. For Chevrolet for $950. The guy answered it, went out to the little old lady's house, and they uncovered the 1974 Chevrolet. It turns out to be a Corvette, and he gives the lady the money, and he walks off with the new car.
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
And still a funny smell in it? Or
no, but what happens is the son of the lady had gone to Vietnam as a soldier and had died shortly after purchasing the car. So the death and the Corvette are tied together, but in two different circumstances 25 years later.
Yeah, it's interesting that you relate those two. I think of them both as wishful thinking stories. You know, you'd love to find that bargain car. And the first one, the death car, is what folklorists call it, I believe, is the first urban legend I ever heard. I was in high school in the early 50s, and it was a $50 Buick. And supposedly, you know, the smell of death was in the upholstery, and they could never get it out. And, of course, we never found the car. We never smelled the car. We never met anyone who had. I've heard this detail with your second story, that the woman, wanting to finally kind of come to closure with the loss of her son, decides to sell the car. She calls a Chevy dealer and says it's a small car, it's an old car, it only seats two, and they suggest, well, it's probably not worth more than a few hundred dollars. And, of course, it's a vintage Corvette that she's selling.
1-800-423-8255, the urban legends connection. Amber is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Welcome, Amber.
Thank you. I have to admit I'm not very familiar with the subject matter, but A few.
That's never stopped you, girl.
Well, many years ago, the one in my community, which would be the African American community, which really irritated me for a long time, was the idea that the federal government had rigged up AIDS in a lab just to give to black people. And I used to scream at everyone I knew, that's impossible, it's not true. Then, of course, you sat there and a few years went by and you heard all these stories about syphilis being given to black men in Alabama, and you went, possibility. Mm. Of course, I don't believe it. The place where I have encountered the most of these now is on the internet. It's amazing how much there is out there and how you get it from people you would never expect who buy into this, and yet when you first read it, of course you believe it. There is the famous KFC one that's going around now, that Kentucky Fried Chicken had to change their name because they no longer use real chickens, and you'd be amazed how many people believe that. There is the Mountain Dew is excellent birth control because it lowers the male sperm count. I, for one, am not running out to buy Mountain Dew to give to any of the people I know, but it's amazing how the internet is an amazing source for this kind of information. And people.
Wait a second. Mountain Dew is a kind of birth control, lowers the sperm count. Where does one get this sort of
wisdom?
where does one learn it? Who sends you that on the internet?
You'd be amazed. People, I can't call their name, but people who should know better, but they just do. And I have this whole theory in my head that maybe, you know, it's Coca-Cola doing it to get Pepsi or something, you know, corporate intrigue, espionage. I just create my own little scenario about why somebody would do that. It's quite fascinating, actually. That's just all I wanted to add.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Amber. Jan Brunvand, do you want to comment on those?
I sure do. That opens a whole lot of things. First of all, I want to be sure to put in a plug for a wonderful book on African-American urban rumors and legends that deals with things such as Amber was describing. It's Patricia Turner, who's at the University of California, Davis, and her book is called I Heard It Through the Grapevine, and it specifically focuses on stories like that that circulate among African-Americans. The Internet, I get it all the time, too. People that I don't even know forward me all kinds of things that they've heard or that they've got from someone else on the Internet. So the Internet has speeded up the circulation of these legends, has also provided a forum for discussing them. People add little comments. Sometimes the comment is something like, I don't know if this is true, but better safe than sorry. And then they'll send you a story about, you know, ankle slashers hiding under cars in the local shopping mall.
And if you send it to 50 friends, that won't get you.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, there are Internet sites where people are archiving urban legends, debunking them, writing articles about them, and so on. So there's a whole library of stuff out there on the Internet as well. I kind of prefer the oral tradition because then you have face-to-face interaction. You have gestures, facial expressions, responses of people listening, and so on. Sort of old-fashioned in terms of folklore.
1-800-423-8255, the Urban Legends Connection. Bill is calling from Cambridge.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Morning, Bill.
I taught English in Poland for a year, and I was running out of subject material as a conversation class, and I found that urban myths turned out to be just a great conversation piece around American culture, and also it really captured their attention. They never heard anything quite as outrageous as someone losing a kidney in Amsterdam.
What's the kidney, the lost kidney story? That's a type unto itself.
Yeah, it's sort of like the American backpackers on a trip through Europe and goes on a bit of a bender in Amsterdam and winds up taking a female guest home and wakes up in the morning knocked out in the bathtub all night with a kidney missing.
Yeah, and a little note that says call 911 or whatever the number is in Amsterdam.
Right.
See, in the United States, that's told about Las Vegas, and he wakes up in a bathtub full of ice with a note, and he reaches for the telephone, it's been around for a long time, this story.
Absolutely.
So you told these, and what was
you
the
told them in Poland, or they had heard them before you got there?
I'm sorry?
Had they heard them before you got there, or did you tell them?
They had never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
It was absolutely from a different planet, the kind of stories that people were telling. I brought in a number of stories that I gathered from other American teachers, and no one had anything relating to an urban myth from Polish culture. There was no such similar story. I mean, the stories all were around maybe something outrageous that had happened during World War II, for instance, that had never been really ever proven as true or false. But there was nothing quite as outrageous as the urban myths that we were talking about.
Well, if I... if I may say so, I beg to differ. I don't understand Polish, but I have a collection of Polish urban legends, and it has an English summary. And you're quite right, though. Many of the stories deal with specific Polish historical regional topics.
Not to be confused with Polish jokes.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Give us an example of the Polish urban legend.
You want me to?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, dear. I haven't got it in front of me.
Bill?
I can't. Maybe Bill can. I was just going to say, though, that there is actually an International Society for Contemporary Legend Research, ISCLR, and there is a Polish member. His name is long and has a lot of Z's and C's in it. I have a note on it at home. And he sent me his collection of urban legends. But he's a pioneer in the field, and all I really can get from it is what's in the summary. But the genre is international, although not all the individual stories we have in the States obviously are told in all these other countries.
Bill, can you tell one of your best ones in 30 seconds?
I'll give it a shot. Woman takes a nap on a beach in South Africa, wakes up with a bug bite on her cheek, doesn't go away. A couple days later, she wakes up and baby spiders are crawling out.
Yipes.
Ooh. We're talking about urban legends with Jan Harold Brunvand, who is a collector and an analyst and a folklorist on the whole subject. He fits them into 400 types, for starters, and then into the sort of grand storytelling psychology of the whole wide world. What are your favorites? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Urban Legends Connection with Jan Harold Brunvand, folklorist, collector, analyst of these stories. You know, we haven't even mentioned one of the great propagators of urban legends, none other than the former president, Ronald Reagan, a brilliant teller of stories, and he often seemed to believe these things. I mean, I remember, especially in the 70s, he used to tell that Welfare Queen of Chicago story, the woman with real estate, Cadillacs. She may have been the same woman who went to Hawaii for a big vacation on her food stamp money. He had that wonderful story about the black cook, must have been in the Navy at the time of Pearl Harbor, who got out and had at the Japanese planes that were bombing Pearl Harbor with a machine gun. He also, Ronald Reagan had a wonderful story about the janitor who in fact wrote the Declaration of Independence. The Founding Fathers were sitting around, you know, stalemated in the production of this document, and he finally said, come on, guys, here's how to do it, and wrote it for them. Do you want to credit Ronald Reagan here, Jan Brunvand?
Well, I didn't know about all these. I knew about the Welfare Queen story. Yeah, the great communicator. He certainly knew how to tell a story, and I don't know what his sources were, but I think there's an article here somewhere.
He didn't know either what the sources were. I mean, they were movies. They were American mythology. They were out of the water somehow.
Yeah, I'm reading Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World. I think that was Carl Sagan's last book, and he mentions Reagan telling a gripping personal experience story from the Second World War, which was a scene out of a movie that he had been in, not anything that he had done.
Yeah, this happened a lot.
But, you know, the truth never stands in the way of a good story. I think I learned that in journalism school.
Yeah, between the legend and the fact. Print the legend. 1-800-423-8255, the Urban Legends Connection. Larry is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Larry. Welcome.
Hi. This is a story that I heard when I was a kid in Russia. It's about the Russian mine dog. apparently in World War II, I heard. I was told by my friends and family. These dogs had explosives strapped to their bodies, and they would run up to German tanks and blow them up. Then on the internet fact, there was an internet fact on urban legends. And according to that fact, it was an urban legend. This wasn't a true. But a year ago on a trip to Russia, I saw in a military museum a whole exhibit on mine dogs. So the question is this an urban legend or is this true?
You know, I think it's both. I haven't researched it closely, but I've heard of similar things, bats with small incendiary bombs on them that are, you know, released. But, you know, wouldn't they come back to where they live? I recognize that exploding animal theme as certainly being part of some urban legends. For example, there's a story about hunters who are out duck hunting, and the pond or the lake they're going to hunt on is frozen, and they decide they have to break up some open water to get some ducks to land, and they haven't got any good tools, but they have some dynamite. So they light a stick of dynamite, throw it out, and they're retriever rushes out, grabs the stick, and comes running back, and the guys all, you know, scatter in horror, and the dog ends up going under the Jeep and blowing it to smithereens. So it's a kind of a comic revision of that idea. But I'm not absolutely certain whether the incendiary animals or the loaded animals are actually part of warfare or not. You say you found a frequently asked question list that denied it, and then at the same time you saw an exhibit in a museum that confirmed it.
Yes.
Holy cow.
They had these,
I think I need a grant. I think I need to get a grant and go to Russia and check this out. It's a great story.
You know, but
it's the St. Petersburg Museum of Artillery. In
I'll
case
be darned.
You ever go down?
Yeah. I'll take a look if I ever get there.
Let me ask you, Jan Brunvand, I mean, does being an urban legend mean that it can't be true?
No, they can't. They certainly can be true. But in the telling and retelling, the details will vary, and there's always some element of truth in the stories. If it's about a shopping mall, shopping malls exist, and sometimes crimes occur there. But that specific event, you know, just last week, according to the story, where those details didn't occur.
So I was thinking of the that story about the television cowboy, the Morning Star, the Morning Kids Show guy who says that'll shut the little bastards up.
Yeah.
You know, when he thought he was off camera. I grew up on that story. I thought I knew the guy who did it. I mean, it was told in broadcasting circles as if it were absolutely fact. And you write, it's in one of your books, that this legend exists everywhere and it may never have happened.
You know, it also exists in some of the blooper tapes and records. You can hear Uncle Don actually saying, that ought to hold the little bastards for another day. The trouble is, if you collect several of these, you know, there were different editions of these tapes and records, and there are blooper books, the text varies. There'll be a little intro song on one, not on the other. The words will be a little different. The sound level is different. I mean, they can't all be authentic. And every biography of Uncle Don, every article about this early children's show person deny it, and he denied it, and so on and so on. It certainly must be every broadcaster's nightmare, though, don't you think?
Yeah, I had nothing to do with broadcasting when I heard it. It may be everybody's nightmare, which reminds me of dreams. I mean, what would Sigmund Freud or a dream analyst grouping, you know, all those classic nightmare or dream things, you know, you go to work without your pants on, or you're not prepared for the exam dream.
That's a nightmare that I've had, haven't you?
Of course. Is there a sort of crossover in the typologies here of urban legends and sleeping dreams?
Well, I think there's some. It depends on the story. For example, there are urban legends where people are caught in the nude, and that's one of the horror dreams that people have, one of the scary dreams. They wake up sweating. You know, they dream that they were walking the streets with no clothes on or something. Let me turn it around a little bit, though. There are folklorists who take a Freudian approach to analyzing urban legends. The most prominent is Alan Dundy's at the University of California, Berkeley. We were fellow graduate students at Indiana, and he went towards the Freudian, and I went towards the historic and comparative look at folklore. He looks at the story of the Hook Man, for example. You remember that one? The kids parked on Lover's Lane. cuddling, making out, necking. What is the term people use nowadays? It isn't canoodling.
Spooning used to be. Go ahead.
Spooning. I think
we get the idea.
Anyway, the radio music is interrupted by a warning that a dangerous individual has escaped from a nearby asylum. Everyone should be on the lookout. He has a hook in place of a hand, and that's how they can identify him. And the girl is frightened and asks the guy to take her home. He speeds out of the parking place. When they get home, they find this hook dangling from the door handle. This is a badly told summary. Dundee's looked at that story and suggested that the hook man on the outside tapping on the window was a counterpart to the sexual advances of the boyfriend who's trying to get his hooks into the girl. He's tapping seductively at the window as if trying to get at her. When the hook is torn off, it's obviously a castration symbol, and so on and so on. So, you know, that's a possibility to see these as symbolizing something other than just the surface content. Though on the surface, that's an interesting enough story. It's what every parent used to say to kids, you know, don't stay out too late, be careful, you take care of my little girl, and so on. And then these dangers are out there. Of course, the story is completely illogical. I mean, would they give the guy a hook if he was a dangerous maniac? Would he reach for the door handle with his hook instead of his good hand? And what are the odds that he would be out there just at the time when the announcement is made on the radio? But he has to be, or there's not a story. I think the most unbelievable part is that the young man walks politely around the car to open the door. Of course, he has to, or you wouldn't have that concluding image.
Well, as you say, the truth never stands in the way of a good story. We're talking about urban legends with Jan Harald Brunvand. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Jeremy is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
I'd like to start out by saying I heard it was Eddie Murphy in the elevator, and that when he and two ladies got in and he became exasperated with them just nervously standing there, realizing they were in an elevator with, you know, this black man, he pointed to the buttons and he said, "Hit the floor."
Yep.
Boom, down they went.
Yeah. And I've heard that
he probably told the story that way.
He might have.
Well, I've heard that Eddie Murphy, when he realized what was happening, said, "That's the funniest thing that's happened to me all day. I'll put it in my next movie." But, of course, you never see it in the movie.
Well, I'm calling to give voice to a suspicion that I have.
Okay.
I come from up in Maine originally, and there's a real long...
If you were a real Mainer, you'd say down in Maine, right?
Well, I'm in Rhode Island, and, you know, I tend to think in geographic terms now.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a real long tradition of these funny, very pithy, small stories about hunting exploits or, you know, various things that happen. And what it seems like to me is that these stories are a way for people to satisfy this very old urge to spin a yarn and, you know, and sort of indulge in a sort of performance without seeming silly or old-fashioned or hokey or contrived or something, that there's this veneer of reality and truth to it that allows people to indulge in sort of like, you know, a much older sort of yarn telling.
I think that's very well put. Yeah. Do you have a story now in mind to illustrate that?
I can't say. Let me just tell you the favorite little nugget I have from down Maine.
Please.
It's not exactly in the model, but it's quick and we'll like it. And it goes, "My wife just had a baby. She thinks he's some cunning. But you give me a piece of soft pine and a sharp knife, and I could whittle you a better-looking baby than the one I got." Just a quickie.
Yeah, regional dialect folk humor.
Jeremy, you're great. You're great. You are from Maine. We believe it now. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255, the urban legends connection. Mac is calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, good morning. Really enjoying the show.
Good, Mac. Thank you. Thanks for calling.
I was happy to hear about Alan Dundas. I really enjoyed his Life is Like a Chicken Coop Ladder. He had some good insights there, didn't he?
Yeah, that's the title of one of his books, yeah.
Exactly.
Translate it. What does it mean?
Well, it's basically the top chicken or the top dog is the one who sits on the top of the ladder, and the rest down below suffer accordingly, according to how low they're sitting.
I get it. All right.
It's not that. But the one point that I wanted to mention, a possibility for the origin of some of the urban myths or urban legends, is in government propaganda of different sorts. I've read that during the Second World War, there were various rumors or myths that Hitler and Goering and Goebbels were suffering from varying degrees of sexual dysfunction. One of these said that Hitler had only one testicle and that the Goering and Goebbels were similarly affected. And after the war, a number of legitimate historians looked into that, and they found out that this came back to a U.S. Army and British Army psychological warfare effort to discredit the Nazi leadership in the eyes of a lot of the people in the countries that they had overcome, and even in Germany too, to make them think that they were sexually incapable. And then during the Cold War, I remember reading that the Soviet KGB had started rumors or myths that in Central America there were these camps run by American firms for unwed mothers, and that when they were forcibly aborted or when they delivered their fetuses or their infants, then would be mined for research tissue or for body parts for wealthy Americans in the United States. Now, I understand that this latter one has gotten some presence on the Internet. I don't know whether you've heard of that one or not.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility that governments' disinformation campaigns can spin off into folklore and be repeated. That would only explain a limited number of the legends in certain topics, but I think it's a definite possibility. Very, very hard to pin down, though.
Can these things be manufactured, or do they have to sort of come out of some deeper root?
Well, they have to come from somewhere. I a couple of times have sort of playfully made up a story. The trouble is, my stories that I make up tend to be variations of stories I've heard. I've got too many in my head to come up with anything totally original. But some of them may be deliberate hoaxes that people have invented and started. But in general, I think when we talk about origin of urban legends, everyone who tells, who repeats, who adds a little detail, who varies it, is part of the process of creation of that story. Hmm. It's sort of recreated every time it's told.
The Urban Legends Connection, 1-800-423-TALK. Is our phone. Bernard is on the line.
Oh, hi there. This is great listening to this. I was just wondering, I heard something that I thought was a new urban legend developing out of fact, which was that one of our relatives sent us a story that she had got from an allergy food network about someone who had a friend who was poisoned by had an allergic reaction to a tomato that had shrimp genes inserted into it. And it was genetically engineered tomatoes are bad for you. And the interesting thing is that there's actually a good deal of discussion about whether this is in fact the case or not.
Hmm. And, well, yeah. Have you heard of the tomato with shrimp genes in it?
Yeah.
No, I've heard of bananas with flesh-eating bacteria in them coming in from Costa Rica. That's sort of a variation on the theme.
Yeah, and it just, I'll tell you what I'm thinking, and then I'll get off the air, is about, they talk about various viruses in the Internet sense and about how much productivity they destroy. And, for example, if you go to the U.S. Post Office main page today, there's a hyperlink to a press release of May 25th about the Clingerman virus.
Oh, there is?
Yeah.
Huh. Which apparently the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta says
is fake.
Does not exist.
Right. So that means that's two major organizations have already wasted time and effort discounting the rumor.
Hmm. Yeah, the post office also recently had to deal with a very widespread rumor that that Congress was about to pass a law to tax all of our email in order to support the post office, which was losing money on first-class mail. And this story circulated with the name of the congressman, the number of the bill, the name of a law firm that was fighting it, lobbying against it, et cetera. And everything in it was completely baloney. There was no such congressman. They don't number bills that way. There isn't any such scheme to tax email and so on. Mm. But a lot of this stuff that flies around, the Internet is a wonderful source to look things up and to communicate. But a lot of this stuff that flies around on it is just in the category of rumor, legend, hearsay, and so on, I think.
Bernard, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Clarice is on the line.
I just love the Blue Book story and plan to use it today or tomorrow at my horror 60th reunion at Wellesley College.
Good for you.
But the story I want to tell you about was printed nationally in the newspapers and was probably beloved by all the men of the nation, and I'm sure you've heard it, and that is about the motorist whose battery went dead. He hailed down a passing car, turned out to be a woman driver who was very congenial. Yes, she'll turn around and try to get him started. And he said, be sure to get me going at a good clip. So she turned around and went back. When he looked up at his rearview mirror, there she was barreling down the highway at about 45, 50 miles an hour.
Yep.
I don't know if that's part of your legend. And it, of course,
absolutely.
Most of the newspapers ran it and did not print denial, so the men had a great time, real MCP story for them. Thank you for taking my story.
Clarice, thank you.
You're welcome.
And happy reunion.
You know, that story has been around since when automatic transmission was introduced. And it usually is that he says, this car has automatic transmission. You have to get it up to 35 miles an hour to start it. And so the woman, misunderstanding, backs away and comes at him at that speed. Then what happens? You get cruise control decades later, and you get a story about somebody buying a new van with cruise control, having the whole thing explained by the salesman, and he takes it out on the highway, sets the cruise control at 60 miles an hour, and steps in the back of the camper van to make himself a cup of coffee or to use the toilet or something like that. So, you know, you get a new technological advance in cars in this case, and then you get a story about it.
1-800-423-8255, the Urban Legends Connection. Walter is on the line.
Hi. Something else road-related. I keep on hearing a debate about the Darwin Awards winner, the guy who put the JADO unit in his Impala, whether that's really true or not. Do you know about that at all?
Tell the story. It doesn't sound familiar.
Go ahead.
A guy puts a jet-assisted takeoff unit on his Chevy Impala and after a few hundred yards becomes airborne and slams into a cliff 3 miles away. He won the Darwin Awards, I guess, a couple years ago. I hear this from a lot of people. I see it on the web. Supposedly he launched the car and managed to keep it going in a straight line for 3 miles where he could, you know, in spite of melting his brakes, slams into a cliff wall and kills himself.
Christopher, do you know what he means by the Darwin Awards?
No.
It's an award given to people who take themselves out of the gene pool, so to speak.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think there is any such award. And I've always wondered who starts this whole thing. I've got that story and lots of others. Over and over again, you get a list of 10 or 12 of these bad ends that people come to because of their own ignorance or foolishness. And they'll say, you know, these are the Darwin Award winners for this year. But you get it over and over again. As for that jet-assisted takeoff story, I've seen it asserted both ways, that it never happened, it couldn't possibly happen, or that, you know, I know someone who knows someone that can prove that it happened. Now, my opinion is that it didn't happen and that it's an example of an urban legend.
1-800-423-8255. Diana is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Diana. Welcome.
Hi. I actually have one story, and I have one question.
Go for it.
And the story is about the two honeymooners who go to somewhere like Jamaica, some tropical island. This is always told as my office worker's cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that the two go down for a honeymoon, and one night they go out for dinner, and they come back to their hotel room, and it's been burglarized and it's ransacked. And they find that nothing is missing, so they continue the honeymoon. And when they come back to the States, they go and develop their film. And when they get their film back, they find one odd image of these two people mooning their camera with colored sticks protruding out of their bottoms.
Oh, no, not the toothbrushes.
Yes, and they find out that those were their toothbrushes.
Yeah, actually,
in your book.
Oh, yeah, I call it indecent exposure. And the way I've heard it is everything is missing from the room except the camera and the toothbrushes. And, of course, the hotel makes up for all the losses and pays for their vacation and so on. And, you know, you could sort of think ahead and imagine what's going to happen. What I always wonder about that is, why does nobody have the photograph? You know, even if it happens, a horrible thought, but wouldn't you save the picture? And, of course, you never see the picture. You never see the photograph. What's your question?
The question is, I don't know if you've seen the movie Magnolia.
The scuba diver in the tree.
Yes.
I have not seen the movie yet. I've run into that story in lots of different
formats. Who can tell the story super fast? Jan, why don't you try it?
The charred body of a scuba diver is found in a tree after a forest fire. Why? Supposedly, the airplane that scoops up water from a lake to drop in the fire has scooped up the scuba diver. Never happened.
Too good to be true is the code in these urban legends, or as Jan Harald Brunvold called his new book, The Truth Never Stands in the Way of a Good Story. Listeners, you can continue spinning urban legends on our website at theconnection.org. Jan Harold Brunvand, thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
The devil bowed his head because he knew that he'd been beat. And he laid that golden fiddle on the ground at Johnny's feet. Johnny said, devil, just come on back if you ever want to try again. I done told you once, you son of a bitch, I'm the best there's ever been. He played, bound about, run, boy, run. Devil's in the house of the rising sun. A chicken in the grass, better picking out dough. Granny, we don't fight no child, no.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafoods, presenting a new location at Copley Place on Level 2, serving fresh seafood in a fresh new decor. Legal Seafoods, if it isn't fresh, it isn't legal. And Pandesic, a commerce platform.